The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Mike Rupert again on a very cold and wet Sunday, November 20th, 2011 here in Sebastopol. Cold and wet for us here. It's low 40s outside. It'll probably get down into the high 30s tonight. It's a lot worse than a lot of other places. My apologies to Gary Null when he wanted to put me on before the top of the show. I had just stepped away to the restroom, of course, and I wasn't there. I'm sorry, Gary. Sorry I missed you. But I'm sure we'll catch up next week or down the road. So. Okay, what a week. I mean, it's been so intense. I sat down yesterday. I usually start to try to put the show together in my head on Saturdays, and I was trying to recap all the things that had happened this week, and it seems like there was a, 6 months worth of activity just in the last week. If you've been following me for a while, and if you've been reading what we've been saying on CollapseNet, I guess it's been since September now that I've been saying very clearly that events were being coordinated and synchronized, so that I said that the whole global economy could be more or less shut down all at once. Well, it's an interesting set of circumstances, but that looks like exactly what's happening. And get ready, because tomorrow is going to be a day I have no idea how tomorrow's going to play. But let me just tell you why. There's two Bloomberg headlines tonight. Super Committee said to announce no agreement reached. Well, duh. We all knew that. I've been telling you for a while. This was going to fail. It was kind of obvious. U.S. Super the second Bloomberg headline is U.S. Debt Super Committee announcement said likely on Monday. That would be tomorrow. Now, what will happen when the Super Committee announces is that the $1.2 trillion estimated in budget cuts will take place automatically. We don't know where yet, and of course that's the $64,000 question. I heard some good rumors that I suspect indicate it'll be Section 8 housing vouchers. It'll be the poorest taking the biggest hits first. And the government, of course, the failed U.S. government will just throw up its hands and say, well, it's politics, partisan, et cetera. But at the same time, with Europe, which is, I had a headline this week that I thought was said it pretty well. Titanic bow slips below waterline, Europe drowns. Bond sales have basically, the bottom has fallen out of the bond market, sovereign bonds. Nobody's buying Italian bonds. They're dumping Spanish bonds, and there's nobody out there buying. One of the big tennis balls being bounced back and forth across the net for the past couple of months had been, would the ECB be the buyer of last resort? Well, the answer is no. That's monetizing debt. The Germans won't allow that. That's what led to Weimar and the hyperinflation before the Nazis took over. But speaking of which, we should cue some background music. If I had a big budget and a producer, we'd do that. We'd play Deutschland über alles in the background. What's happening in Europe is that the banks, the biggest banks, are putting bankers in as heads of governments. And it's happened in Greece and Italy, as Gary was talking about in the last show. And this is the Germans putting bankers in to impose a little discipline countries that haven't, of course, all they're doing is beating on the people. But Germany is taking over Europe. There's been some great oratory given in the European Parliament this week from Nigel Farage, and I forget the other member, but there was one telling commentary as these bankers were taking over in Greece and Italy, I'm sure soon to be Spain, and everywhere else. That's what Angela Merkel was talking about when she said the EU is going to get bigger, not smaller. The Germans, we lent all these people their money, they didn't pay us back, and now we have to impose some discipline. I guess it's in the genes. But that's coming tomorrow, too. And so tomorrow looks like it could be an inside-out day. What will happen as the super committee fails is that the U.S. Credit rating will almost certainly be downgraded again, which will mean a recalculation of interest rates almost immediately, which will mean we have passed the $15.2 trillion debt ceiling, and we hit $15 trillion this week as oil passed $100 again. This is all very cheery stuff. And with the downgrade, of course, will come a whole new set of budget crises, and our markets will show that. And there will be really no safe place to run if both of those events happen simultaneously. There's no place for capital to flee to that is safe. And that's all coming down tomorrow. Now, one thing we can... I'm going to dedicate our new white trash song to this story tonight. High-end New York apartment prices tumble with Wall Street layoffs. That's in Forbes. All those apartments in the 70s and 80s on the east side around the park, you know, west side around the park. Hey, you know, you can move into a luxury suite on the Titanic now if you're looking for a bargain there. But we'll dedicate a song here in a few minutes to all the brokers who have been laid off from the big financial houses. And that's what's causing this. We have to have sympathy. So with all of that going on, it has been an unbelievably tumultuous week for the Occupy movement. And probably the most important thing, we're going to spend quite a bit of time on it, that I see that happened, was a confrontation at UC Davis. It really wasn't necessarily an Occupy, but on the other hand, it was. We all know it's the same issue in the same time in the same place. The Davis incident is really mind-boggling. But we have seen, of course, the assaults on a number of camps, the shutdown, and the morphing and the evolution of the Occupy movement in many ways around the world. And that, in a very large sense, really corresponds with my view of how the world is going to work after this collapse. I was talking with Carolyn Baker on the show last week, and you know, I was talking about someone asking me to envision what I thought an Occupy would look like or what an end result looked like, and I said I can't do that because it's place that determines everything. And so it is with the Occupy movement. I was really pleased to see Occupy London move into, I believe it was a vacant UBS office building, and apparently there's some English laws which allowed that to happen. And I'm really encouraged to see a lot of creative evolutions. What we can all see, whether we're involved in the Occupy movement or not, is that it isn't going away. The energy is popping up. It's like squeezing a balloon now, and you don't know where it's going to come out. But the Occupy movement is doing something extremely important. What it's doing is it's forcing people in positions of power and authority to question. Occupy London has forced the Church of England in the city of London to really acknowledge a severe moral crisis, which I'm not sure is resolved. And if we have any listeners out there tonight in London, let us know. I haven't seen any indication. I believe a lawsuit's about to be filed by City of London. But we saw that elsewhere. But I think what happened at UC Davis, for me, was one of the most amazing watershed moments I've ever seen. I got to remember, I was a cop, and I have seen a lot, not a lot of them. I've seen civil unrest up close and personal several times, and I have never seen the look of fear that I saw on the faces of about 15 UC Davis police officers. And this tape is legendary around the world right now. I mean, it's on the Time magazine website. It has gone extremely viral. You see a cadre of 10, 15 UC Davis police officers led by a lieutenant. There's a sergeant out there. And the lieutenant, who looked like a caricature, actually, with this big can of pepper spray, looks like a fire extinguisher, just hosing like he was watering his front lawn, about, I guess, 12, 15 students who were just sitting peacefully, blocking a sidewalk at UC Davis. And it was a pretty, it was a very grueling tape. A lot of people were so shocked by what they saw in the first 2-3 minutes of that tape. It's about an 8-minute tape, and it's up on the CollapseNet site. You can find it anywhere. Just Google UC Davis, but watch the whole tape. This was clearly an unprovoked, unjustified attack. We know that because everybody can see it. The chancellor has resigned, and that's good. There are cracks in the edifice. But right after the spraying and the arrests, the crowd was incensed at the overt brutality, and abuse. Some beautiful things started to happen. Mic checks are very powerful, as I know from Occupy Santa Rosa. But a mic check went out, and first of all, a real tribute to all of those who sat down on the sidewalk, prepared to take that medicine, and you took it like champs, your warriors, your heroes. That was inspiring. But somebody back in the crowd said, "Mic check, mic check," and you know it started off, "Shame on you," and it got loud. I don't know how many students were there, but there were probably at least several hundred. You know, it sounded like thousands at one point. Shame on you, shame on you. And it dawned over the course of about 2 minutes on the cops that, oh, wait a minute, we're like Custer at the Little Bighorn here. Then the chant morphed to "Whose University? Our University," which is a common chant throughout the movement. Mic check, mic check, mic check. And whoever was leading said, we are willing to give you a brief moment to leave. Take your weapons," and this is all being mic checked, so the crowd is doing this and with extreme power and focus. They were a tight band. You know, "We are to give you a brief moment to leave, to take your weapons. Please do not return." Picture the crowd repeating this. "We have given you a moment of peace. You can go. Go. We will not bother you." And I saw the spirits in the cops break, and I saw them doing a slow, measured withdrawal from the field, about 50 to 75 yards backwards, and they left. And for me, I have never seen police officers do that in my lifetime, not with that kind of look. And what I saw was the effect of people like Shamar Thomas and the wonderful Captain Ray Kelly of the Philadelphia Police Department, who went out and got arrested, came back, got out, was back down there offering to get arrested again. He did a we have an interview with him from, I think it was MSN. And so all of this pressure on police is having an effect, and all of this pressure on heads of universities is having an effect, and all of this pressure on churches is having an effect as the movement continues to remain nonviolent no matter what. And my hat is off to the movement everywhere. But there are lots and lots of problems in Occupy. We're going to talk about those in some detail tonight. If you want, if you're an occupier especially, and you want to get on to talk about some of the stuff we're talking about, the number is 1-888-874-4888, 874-4888, or email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. We want input on this, definitely. Tonight, and I've been contacted by people from Occupies in several places in this country and in a couple of other countries, and what they're saying is, "We don't want to publicize that we're having this problem, but they're all having the same problem, and it's the same problem that I saw at Occupy Santa Rosa this week, which is why I pulled out, one of the reasons why I pulled out, but there were so many agents provocateurs and there that it was impossible to get anything done, and there were a lot of other agendas being followed in Santa Rosa. We had been extremely successful, no violence, and that's something we take proudly from Occupy Santa Rosa. The camp is still there, but we were having way too many problems with drunks, with drug addicts, with criminals who would come into the camp. And that appears to be a common problem. And it's no surprise, certainly, to law enforcement or to the powers that be. We have stories, speaking to someone who had been around Occupy San Francisco and Occupy Oakland, same thing, that the cops are telling the homeless, telling the mentally ill to go to the Occupy camp because they want to create these kinds of problems. And that is that's a weakness and a great difficulty of the movement that it had when it set up, and it is an Achilles heel. What we're doing in Santa Rosa might be indicative, and I think it is, of things that are happening all throughout the movement in different ways. Now, in Santa Rosa, I had mentioned it twice when I spoke to City Council. That there was a strong permaculture transition community here, and there's a reason why Transition US is here, why Post Carbon is here, why I'm here, why incredible places like Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, Trayton Heckman's Daily Axe, and a wonderful guy who I've just met named Eric Olson. I'm sorry I don't have his card with me, but he stepped forward, and he's a giant also in permaculture. Had all expressed support for Occupy Santa Rosa, so we have some community support. And one of the things, I'm in an affinity group, and we are strategizing, and of course we're going to meld permaculture into occupying a piece of land. That's pretty much a given. And we're going to grow food. Then we will invite the issues, of course, of the FDA, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? We have to draw a line somewhere. It's not fair to make the city of Santa Rosa a battleground against Wall Street, where the city of Santa Rosa would have their operations disrupted, spend all their money, because they're going down the tubes like the rest of us. So I think it was a wise decision made here. One of the first things that we did in this affinity group was we realized that we had to have community agreements up front, clearly stated, that allowed for us to screen people for intake and allowed for us to fairly remove people or ask people to leave. You know, you might find what you're looking for better someplace else. You won't find it here. Using the models of many intentional communities that exist in the area here, so that there is, if you will, a tribal custom set so that order can be maintained and so that there is some control because the powers that be are taking advantage of this chaos, and trust me, they're going to be sending everybody they can think of who will make trouble into the Occupy movement. I'm really, really, really happy to see so many permutations appearing. You know, every time I write something that seems to think that Occupy has lost in an area, of course, I made a fool of quickly thereafter. And I wrote this week that Occupy couldn't hold the big space anymore. Well, what it's doing now is it's creating lots of other new spaces where the power of the movement can show itself. Here's an example. I clipped this. Zurich, this is from Reuters, a Swiss youth party called on activists on Sunday to stage an Occupy World Economic Forum protest from igloos, which I love, when the global elite descend on the ski resort of Davos for their annual meeting on January. Go ahead, baby, confiscate my igloo. It's ice. I still am enamored of the tent as our symbol, because there has never been a mortgage on a tent. And I've never seen a tent with a two-car garage. I've never seen a tent with a TV antenna. Not that those exist anymore, but you get the point. A tent symbolizes freedom from this material paradigm. And Occupy, one of my good friends, Brock Dolman from Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, was at one of these meetings, and Brock's just a brilliant guy. He's a giant in permaculture. I should get him on the show sometime. Very, very funny guy. But he said instead of CSAs, we should have CSOs. And if you follow transition, CSA means community supported agriculture. CSO stands for community supported occupation, and that's the key. Tailor your occupation to the community, to the place where it's taking place, and get support from there as you occupy, before you occupy, so that you have anchors in the community, because we are at the point where we have very little time left, you know, and all we're going to have left to work with is the people who are close by, the local government and the local people, and those are the bonds that need to be kept strongest and reinforced. We have a call already. Michael from Arizona. Michael, are you there?
Hey. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. I was struck by your comment about the troubles that you've had at the Santa Rosa Occupy. And I wanted to comment on that.
Please.
Well, I have been involved in the rural Arizona Occupy protests, principally in Kingman, Arizona, but also in Flagstaff and down in Yuma. And in all three of those locations, the Occupy demonstrations haven't been an actual occupation where people live in a space, but where they go out on a Saturday afternoon and protest or you know, demonstrate. So I was struck by the fact I had gone to the San Francisco Occupy back in October when I was out there. And it reminded me of a rainbow gathering. Are you familiar with those?
Mm-hmm. The old Jesse Jackson stuff, yeah.
No, the rainbow gathering where people come from around the world to go out into the forest.
Oh, from the 70s, yes. Okay, sorry.
Okay, well, that is a lot like an Occupy movement.
Yes.
At least an urban one, except, you know, with a lot less nudity and no trees and such. I mean, there's kitchen set up to feed people right there. There's folks that have attended for to exchange ideas, for transcendence, for spiritual quests, to you know, to protest against problems. It also attracts a lot of people who are there to get high and stay drunk. They call them rainbows sometimes. Are you familiar with that? I bet other members of your audience are.
I'm sure.
So I agree with your suggestion you were making just before about the importance of tailoring your demonstration to the local environment.
Right.
All of those Arizona protests that I've attended and have been weekly things where people gather to make a statement. Perhaps this has to be a large, large thing to really make a change.
Right.
You know, maybe we'll, instead of having people live in a space 24/7, if folks occupied different street corners and really made the message pervasive, it could make a difference.
Yes, well, you know, every place is going to have to evolve as dictated by place, but also in the context of that place's relationship with its police department, policing agency, county government, whatever. But what I'm happy to see, man, is that it's still evolving. It's like it's not going away.
Yeah.
And I love to see the creativity. All right, we're coming up on
Thank
a station
you for
taking
break. My call.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it. We've got to go to a station break here in a couple minutes. Randy from New Jersey, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening, Michael.
Hi.
A great support of yours. I loved your last couple of parish. I immediately got on PayPal and made a contribution.
Thank you.
All right, but the main question that I wanted to ask you is why aren't we focusing more on opting out of this corrupt system as opposed to going down to Occupy Wall Street and protesting a system that we know is an inherently corrupt, bought from the inside, and will never, ever, ever change?
Okay.
We need to be doing a more effort of telling people to opt out of the system, to tell people, hey, get 10 people together and buy 5 acres of land and live off that land and buy physical silver. Things like that, so that they don't rely on the system at all. That's inherently corrupt and will never change.
Okay. You know, that's what I've been doing for 10 years. That's what people like Richard Heinberg have been doing, Transitions, Jim Kunstler, Dmitry Orlov, all of us in the peak oil movement have been advocating that for a decade at least. It's been a matter of getting people's attention, And now we are at a point where there's really not a lot of time left. You do not have time at this point to go shop for acres of land, relocate your family, and start planting crops. We are at the collapse of human industrial civilization right now. So the big question now, and I see this a lot on Facebook and around Occupy, and I've seen it crop up a lot through the Occupy movement. Okay, let's really hurt the banks. Stop paying your bills. And what I've said all along when I've been asked about that, that's a clear way of opting out of the system. Mm-hmm. You have to time that. You have to time that so that when you stop paying your bills, you're not going to be at a place where they're actually going to come, take your car, take your house, take important things. And that point will come eventually because collapse is collapse. I remember when I spoke at University of Washington, Seattle in 05, you know, what I said was get out of debt. And that's the best way to opt out of the system. But we don't have time to do that now because everything is coming down as fast as it possibly can. Transition US, CollapseNet, my site, all of us are about, and at CollapseNet you have a huge resource, though, the free Lighthouse directory, 1,600 entries, plus all the connections we make to people that will help you get out of the city or try to change as quickly as you can, given the fact that we don't have a lot of time now. But there's a lot of work been done on this, and unfortunately, there's a lot of zombies that kind of missed the first 10 rings of the alarm clock here, you know? All right, we're down at the bottom of the hour. Thank you, Randy. We're going to take, we got a couple minutes left. And we started a couple minutes later. All right, I'll talk for a couple minutes, and then I'm producing in my head as we do this. Here's a thought that I'll leave you with right before we go to break. And one of the things that's been said about the Occupy movement is that it doesn't have demands, and I have applauded the fact that it didn't make a list of demands that might have excluded, et cetera, you know, proven to be wedge issues that the opposition could use to tear the movement apart. But there is a really good one on the plate, and to every occupier in the United States of America, I really suggest that you focus on this. It is a wonderful lightning rod. It is a proposed constitutional amendment that a Florida congressman, and hold on a second, I'll give you his name in a minute, but it would overturn the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. It would eliminate personhood for corporations completely, and it would make it a constitutional amendment that corporate money cannot go into politics. And I'll leave you with this thought before we go to station break. The constitutional amendment process, if you look at the Constitution, is pretty exciting. You can do it through the Congress, and I forget, it's three quarters. It'll never happen that way. You can do it through the states. I believe it's three quarters of the states have to ratify. Which would be an extremely galvanizing political process to start occupies in every state in the union. First demand, get this amendment up, ratify it, and make this an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it's something that has the horsepower. But more than that, it's something that strikes directly at a vital organ of the beast of infinite growth. We're going to take a station break. We'll be right back after this.
Take these, you'll be fine. 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 Take these.
Cyanide would be good for some people right about now. I don't know. I saw something that we had on the World News Desk at CollapseNet this week that said that 25% of the people, the adults in this country, are on psych meds, antidepressants. Whoa. Okay, fine. The congressman who has introduced the amendment to the U.S. Constitution is Ted Deutsch, a Democrat of Florida. And you can Google this, but this is very cute because the acronym actually makes sense. The amendment is called, which cut off. It's a, okay, eliminate corporate cash undermining public interest in our election and democracy. It's called the Occupied Amendment, and the acronym, I cut off the first word, but you get the point. You can Google that, and I found this story on rawstory.com. They have a good... they have this good story up there about the amendment that I really think is a galvanizing lightning rod for the movement right now, something that really can put some focus back in the movement. But they also have a great videotape, video interview of Captain Ray Kelly of Philadelphia, who is just one of my heroes, man. He's just, that's my kind of cop, what can I tell you? Okay, let's do a new white trash song. We got some emails, and this is a song that that I want to dedicate to all of those guys who are getting laid off out of Wall Street, and those $1 million, $2 million apartments are, you know, tumbling in price. And this is a song I'll dedicate to you guys, because as somebody once pointed out, which would you rather fall to the gutter from the sidewalk or from the penthouse? Here's a song for Wall Street, Free Fall. Doug Lewis, my bandmate, beloved friend. Dougie wrote in tonight. You can find that song and 36 other originals at newwhitetrash.com. I'm so glad I got to do that before the world came to an end. Anyway, Dougie and I have been talking about, Dougie has this great line about how it's hard to write a protest song on a full stomach. He was lamenting the lack of appearance of some of the big names in protest music, wondering where they were all at. He sent me an email about that before the show. Unfortunately, it's so controlled now, Dougie. You don't know that all of who's been there. Pete Seeger's been there. Crosby and Nash made an appearance. Joni Baez showed up. And, of course, Roger Waters from Pink Floyd came out and did something good. So it's not a total wash there, but I love that line. It's hard to write a protest song on a full stomach. Okay, Jonathan from Plymouth, thanks for waiting for the song. Are you there, man?
Yeah, hey, how you doing, Mike?
All right, man.
I've just been going through a lot of anxiety lately. I've been scared lately about everything happening. So
that's normal. It's okay.
You know, about 2 years ago, I heard from this guy named George Green, and I heard this interview he gave where he said he was at the meetings back in the 70s when they were planning to depopulate the planet and all this. And the things he said about Iran and Israel and stuff, now I hear it on the news, and it sounds like exactly what he was talking about.
Well,
and I just wonder if, like, you know, I mean, doesn't it make sense, like, make it so the zombies never even know what peak oil is and just have a nuclear war?
Well, nuclear wars are not controllable, and I've kind of come to the conclusion after my long career of examining this particular psychopathology that's killing our planet right now and us, is that they're planning a nuclear war like the Three Stooges executed hanging wallpaper. In other words, it's a cluster of you-know-what, and they're backing themselves into that corner. And I'm extremely worried about that, but I don't think it's intentional. On the other hand, I'm aware that all the major wars that have been fought throughout the history of industrial civilization happened because the banks own now, but I'm sure that maybe they can. But we're in a place where these guys are not sane. They are not behaving sanely. Do they have plans for population reduction? You're damn right they do, and there were people screaming about it for a long time. I was one of them. But we didn't do anything about those then.
Like,
I would more expect them in the form of biological weapons. Go ahead.
You hear the propaganda. I don't know if you've heard any propaganda on the mainstream news, but it's unbelievable.
Yeah. We scan all that stuff, and they are a lot of this is distraction. There are three areas in the world I'm concerned about right now. One is the Middle East around Syria, which is getting very, very hot. The second is what will happen around the U.S. deadline for troop withdrawal from Iraq, December 31st. That's just a few days away. And the third, and this is at the top of my list, is the South China Sea. Now, South China Sea is where I really see things could go nuclear in a heartbeat. I hope they don't, but that's one of those situations. If it does, we have nothing to worry about because we're not going to be here to analyze it afterwards anyway.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, but you know what I say every time I put up a story that's commenting on this breakneck move of moves that are escalating tensions to fight over scarce resources so that one nation can grow faster than another. That's the insanity. This is the end of the line, and if everybody would just realize that that growth is no longer possible anyway. There's no spoils to go to the victor here. But that's a moment of sanity I'm not sure we're going to see. We got some other callers, man. Thanks for calling in, John.
Thank you.
Bye. Cameron from New York. You there, man?
I've met you a couple of times in New York.
Cool. What's going on?
Well, I'm just concerned. I'm concerned about what's going on in Egypt right now in Tahrir Square. And, you know, as we speak, people getting killed right now because it seems like all of a sudden they're going all out to clear the square. And, you know, the thing with the principle of nonviolence, which, of course, I follow, and so do all the occupation movements, but it just seems like you're, with nonviolence, you appeal to, you know, a heart that maybe your society or the powers that be have. You appeal to a heart or a system of morality. And what happens when the powers that be don't have a heart anymore?
Well, see, that's what I was talking about earlier. I mean, these are great, deep questions, and I've been wrestling with the same question. But what I see, when you see guys like Captain Ray Kelly stand up, or Shamar Thomas, or me, you know, and we are resonating, us honorable warriors, old though Captain Kelly and I are, we're resonating deeply inside the system, and there's earthquakes because people are... the people who make things run are being forced to choose whether they have a heart or not, and it's a conscious decision for many of them. We've seen the resignations from Mayor Kwan's staff in Oakland. We've seen resignations now at UC Davis, and so this is clearly making the issue, and that's what we want to do. We want everybody to be forced to make that choice sooner rather than later. But Egypt is different. Now, see, what we have shown with the Occupy movement and our steadfast devotion to nonviolence, the power in that. And we are experiencing and enjoying the power in with that. Now, what they can get away with in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, is completely different from what they can get away with here in the States.
Why is that?
Well, the moment that there are massacres, you know, you see an armored personnel carrier roll up and some guy open up with a squad automatic weapon on the crowd, here, it's over here.
It's over for who?
It's over for the U.S. government.
Meaning that people will be so incensed?
Yes. What I mean is that UC Davis may have been our Kent State, the point at which the will of the government to become more brutal is broken. Mm-hmm. And that will happen as it did in Egypt the first time, as it did in Russia in 1917. It will happen when those who have the guns who protect the elites stop. Mm-hmm. That's when it's over. That's when we have won. And that's why I was so happy to see that outcome at UC Davis. And I think some really good stuff, tragic as that event was, may come out of it.
Well, I hope that that is the case. But every time there's a moment like this, I think that has broken the back of the powers that be. How could they possibly proceed the way they're proceeding? Mm-hmm. And then another week goes by and they do something even more brutal. And I'm just wondering. I mean, what if the pepper spray incident does not break their back, and next week, they do come out in more force, and someone gets shot, or you know what I mean? What happens if it does escalate?
Mao Zedong said, "Revolution is not a dinner party."
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens every time something brutal like a UC Davis happens, or Oakland, or any of the things that we've seen? And by the way, I'm very convinced that Scott Olson was shot accidentally by the cop, and it's one of those fog of war tragedies.
Yeah.
But is that every time a brutal incident like this happens, more and more people who you don't hear about go inside and go, oh, that's it, that's enough. And that's mm-hmm. where the momentum is swinging. It may take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these. That's the way the Viet Cong approach it. That's the way every successful, that's the way Che and Castro approached it, is that, they could see the system crumbling with
mm-hmm.
each new attack. And it was just like those students at UC Davis who had the courage, the warriors who laid down there, braced themselves and took the blows.
Yep.
And we will take as many blows as it takes to kill this beast before it kills us. We got some more calls, but thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Kyle from Quebec, you there?
Hey, I'm here.
All right, man. What's up?
Thanks. How you doing, Michael? Thanks for taking my call. I've just got a question here. It's maybe a little off topic. We talk a lot about Occupy right now, but my question is about public transit. In general, I think that up here in northern Quebec, we've got these small cities up here. Cars are obviously non-sustainable, but I'm thinking I'd just like to have your perspective on how you see public transport in the future. I mean, these infrastructures that we have now in these small municipalities, which are our last line of defense, they're not just going to disappear overnight.
No.
So I'm just wondering exactly how you see this in the future, how these services will continue, or how they'll adapt with this the changes that are going to be coming.
I would assess vulnerabilities with public transport by seeing how they've been financed and underwritten. In other words, when they rebuilt the New York subway system, they used a Wall Street investment bank. It'll come to me, Dylan Reed. To do that. So you had all the derivatives mixed in there. And of course, the key is now finding the means, the resources, the money to maintain or to build new local transport. So
to the extent that local transport is exposed to the $1.4 quadrillion derivatives bubble, which is imploding, worry about it seriously. To the extent that public transport is financed by local bonds, by local funding measures, then it has a much better chance of being maintained and taken care of. But this derivatives bubble, I mean, this octopus is into everything, and anything that's exposed to what's happening with derivatives now is at severe risk.
Okay, great. Just a little follow-up on that.
Sure.
We've got this transport system that goes by fixed routes on fixed schedules and whatnot. How do you feel about maybe a transport on demand where people would call and, you know, we might have less buses, but they'd maybe come to your door and actually get you if you call ahead, you know, say a half hour in advance or something like that?
There are. I've been at this, you know, for like a decade, so I've run across maybe hundreds of different locally inspired arrangements like this that are already in full swing. Go to the Lighthouse Directory at CollapseNet.com. But I've seen, you know, ride sharing. I've seen I've seen four or five people who live within a block of each other, pooled by one car. I've seen all kinds of innovations, and necessity is the mother of invention. But again, it all starts from community first.
Great. Well, thanks for your call, and thanks for everything you do.
All right, man. Thank you so much. We got an email from Bill. I got to catch up on the emails here. What are the chances that Spain and France go down this week? Better than 50-50. Italy is already past the point of not being able to default. Spain also this way. France might take a little bit longer, but it'll be a heartbeat, because once this bubble goes, the dominoes are already, it's like five dominoes already falling, and they're falling faster, and the pace of collapse is going to accelerate along with the thuds. I hope that that's true, because we want that fast crash. We want it to be over, because we can't get on with designing anything or building anything that's sane until it is. Doug Seward writes, I received two unusual emails from Tom Brown recently relating, hi Tom, to his concerns about solar flares and how that could potentially affect electric grid, computers, electronics in 12. I would like to hear your take on it. So far I haven't read the original documents he's referencing and have too little information to place this email in context. I've spoken to Tom recently, and he's extremely concerned, also because of grandfather's prophecies, Red Sky being one, and I'm aware of these flares. These are a bit different, because there's been a substantial amount of documentation that these were coming in this time window for a long time. There's also a substantial amount of documentation that it could, you know, there is a polar shift occurring and the Earth's electromagnetic field, which keeps us from getting fried by cosmic rays, thank you Mother Earth, is shifting, and this will have the solar flares, when they arrive, have a good chance of giving like a giant EMP burst to electronics, which could, you know, which would just, we all know how much we depend upon that now. And, you know, but so we're set up here to, you know, to unplug, throw the breakers and get everything offline if we sense everything coming. They could be devastating. But I got to tell you, Doug, at this point, everything is devastating that's happening. And so, you know, pass the popcorn, brother. What can I tell you? We pass the popcorn and just see how this movie plays. And we hope that this change of consciousness keeps happening as fast as we see it. Okay, here's an email that says, please don't use my name. Okay, I am a peace officer in Southern California. We're getting some BS intel now regarding the OWS movement. If you're not receiving any intel from law enforcement, I can send you what I'm getting, but blah, blah, blah. Okay, some of this stuff. Yeah, see attached from counterterrorism. Yeah, okay, so what is happening with Occupy now? And thank you for sending that. You're not the first cop that I've been hearing from. My tape to law enforcement apparently has had some impact, and I'm just gratified to hear that there's so many sane, good, decent brother and sister officers out there.
This is all run by Department of Homeland Security. We've had that on the World News Desk several times this week. And this is an orchestrated, as I said it was going to be, effort. And there's a lot of different agendas being played out, a lot of different tactics being tried. There was a clear move, I think, to rush for a Supreme Court decision, and I'm glad that I'm not aware of any lawsuits being filed in district court, because you have two conflicting district court opinions. But this is a propaganda campaign that is, these are the guys who have been doing this for 40, 50 years. They're all dinosaurs, but they have perfected their game pretty well. And I've received word of this happening in a number of different police departments where it's really bad intelligence. Almost I heard from somewhere else in the Midwest that, it was like nobody could even believe it if they read it, I'm aware that that's going on. We're all aware that that's going on. What I see is that Homeland Security's plan, this is like asymmetrical warfare, and it's like the Pentagon. They don't have all their bases covered here. Everything is being forced to where people are just going to have to make a choice, and we will have to know in our gut if it's right or wrong. So I'd like to thank this person, this peace officer, for sending this in. You're not the first I've heard from this week, and I'm extremely grateful to hear that there's so many peace officers awakening right now. Excuse me, Police Captain Ray Lewis. Somebody corrected me on that. I got him confused with Commissioner Kelly. Captain Ray Lewis from Philadelphia, my apologies to you, Captain. I salute you. You are just an absolutely wonderful, wonderful guy. We look forward to meeting a lot more like you in the weeks and months ahead. All right, so we're down to the last few minutes of the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm kind of mellow tonight because I'm at a point now, and I'm sure that this next week is going to be a week that few of us will ever forget. And there have been so many of those, and they seem to come week after week after week after week from a nightclub at the end of the world. We keep putting one foot in front of the other. We show up and occupy, hang tough. Just don't let the torch go out somehow, because as long as you can find ways to hold open the space, the power is coming to us that will help us to shake at the very foundations, the institutions which enable the infinite growth paradigm to work. I see those cracks happening everywhere. God bless everybody in Occupy London. You guys have done extremely well, and you have held a nonviolent space. As you know, after what tragedies happened in the UK this year, you have, this is now a nonviolent thing, and you have done just a wonderful service with that. Hang tough. Make the buggers in the Church of England make a choice, make a decision, and stand up for it and defend it. That's what we have to make government do. And support the constitutional amendment to end corporate personhood and wipe out political contributions to campaigns. That's something that'll really scare the beast. And doing that through the states, starting the movement up in each state to have and take it to the state legislatures as an initiative, is really going to rock them back on their heels a little bit. We're all doing good. I am proud to be associated with everybody out here in Occupy. I'm real glad to be doing the Lifeboat Hour, and I got one more week with you tonight. We'll be back and see you next week. I'm going to go downstairs and cook some hamburger and sit by the fire. Have a good night, everybody. Brace for the week. We'll see you next Sunday.